Hello, innovators, explorers, and risk takers. Welcome to another episode of the Web3 with Sam Kamani podcast. On today's podcast, I have a very special guest here with me. Her name is Alina Narolinsky, and she is the founder of IronFish. IronFish is an L1 privacy blockchain. So in this episode, we uncover what is a privacy blockchain, why do we even need privacy, or we should care about privacy, how is a privacy blockchain different from a private blockchain. So we talk about all things crypto, the state of the crypto industry in 2023, and what do we need to do for more adoption of crypto this year. We also talk about some really interesting topics, such as the importance of secrecy and privacy during World War II. You are going to find this episode extremely engaging because Alina is so knowledgeable about all things crypto and blockchain. Nothing mentioned in this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Finally, I do not run any ads on this podcast, and my only ask is that you leave a review and a rating on whichever platform you are listening this podcast on. With that out of the way, let's get into it. So Alina, it's great to have you here. It was so good to see you at Collision. I nearly said East Denver, but at Collision. And would love to learn a bit more about IronFish, especially for some of the audience who don't know IronFish, much about IronFish. Can you please tell them a bit about what is IronFish and what problems it solves?
Yeah, so IronFish is a new layer one chain. All transactions on IronFish are completely encrypted, meaning that they are private, and every single transaction has zero knowledge proofs associated with them, such that validators can validate that transaction, even though all of the details are hidden. We're also the only layer one privacy chain that has custom asset support. We built that feature specifically for bridge operators to bridge IronFish to transparent chains, Ethereum, for instance, such that users can transfer their assets from Ethereum to IronFish and use IronFish's generic privacy platform.
Well, that's fantastic. I have some follow-up questions because this is like starting a layer one is not something that people do, or it's not a career choice people grow up thinking about because it is all so new. And we often forget like how small this field is or the number of builders in this field, except for the top four or five chains, like, you know, just remove like Ethereum and Bitcoin and Solana and Polygon and few, like maybe five, six. Most of them have under 200 developers working on that chain. How did you get started? How did you end up starting a L1 chain?
Yeah, so IronFish is very focused on privacy. We do not have smart contract addresses or smart contracts in general. We focus on privacy. So the messaging for us is very clear. If you want to spell smart contracts, go to a platform that supports that best, which I think, you know, is still Ethereum and the Ethereum system at large. And we really focus on privacy. So if you want to have privacy for those assets that you previously worked with on the Ethereum side, we're building bridges such that you can use IronFish as a privacy platform for those digital assets. So yeah, so we view IronFish mostly as like a privacy platform that's chain agnostic. So the two chains that we're trying to bridge to by end of year are obviously Ethereum, the other one being Bitcoin, such that we can prove out that we can bridge to an EVM chain as well as a non-EVM chain and have this anonymity pool that can support multiple assets from multiple different chains. And so for us, it's not like we're competing with mindshare of Ethereum. Like, we're not trying to compete with the Ethereum in terms of like where developers should go. We're trying to augment existing assets. So if you already have a project on Ethereum, for instance, and you want to give your users the ability to have those assets be stored in a privacy layer, then please come talk to us. And we would love to kind of help you out and build towards that.
Well, that's fantastic. And how did you come up with, you know, the idea of IronFish, or how did you end up building a product like IronFish?
Yeah, so my start at crypto started at one of the ETH Global events. I went to ETH Waterloo in 2017, which is a lifetime ago, especially in crypto. Yeah. And that ETH Waterloo hackathon was very special. If you remember the CryptoKitties team, they did their interview there. It was also the very first one. And so I felt very special in that regard, because a lot of the early projects, pretty much all the early projects of Ethereum were there represented in some way. And, you know, one of the reasons why I decided to get into crypto full time is because that community felt very special to me. And it still does to this day. And the story that I always share is that, you know, at 3:30 a.m., I'm trying to like get my Hacksaw project to work. And Dan Finlay, who made MetaMask, is like helping me bug my MetaMask integration Hexagon project at like 3:30 a.m. And I was like, wow, like this is amazing. Like this feels so organic and so like fresh and just so inspiring that I want to work here full time. And so it took me a while and I quit my job at Airbnb, the software engineer, in like mid 2018. And then we started the project like late 2018 or early 2019. And the way I got started into it is, you know, when I decided to focus on crypto full time, you know, kind of work backwards. Like, let's just imagine that in 55, 10, whatever the horizon amount of years, crypto is going to be the ubiquitous payment system of tomorrow. What are we missing to get there? And a lot of people at the time and still today were working on stablecoins and scalability. So ways to have higher transaction throughput. And very few teams were working on privacy, which to me felt like such a big gap. Like if we're trying to build this borderless, unbiased payment system, privacy is just such a paramount feature of that. And it felt like that was the most important thing that I could build. The reason why we chose a layer one chain is we realized that building privacy on top of a transparent system is very hard. You know, take Ethereum, for example, every single transaction has a to and a from field and you have to pay for gas for that transaction. And so it's actually very difficult for you to make anonymous transactions unless you use a relayer, which adds like user friction. And even that is not necessarily private. Yeah. And so we decided to kind of build privacy from the ground up. And we're building an Ironbridge such that, you know, it's kind of plug and play into other ecosystems. And I think like even when we started, we were kind of challenging this idea of like, you know, what is a layer one? What is a layer two? Like just because you're a layer one doesn't mean that you're not building for other chains. And if you're a layer two, doesn't necessarily mean that you're only building for one chain. And so we're kind of thinking of Ironfish as this like chain agnostic kind of tool that can support assets on other chains. So I know that was a long answer, but hopefully
that
helped.
Yeah, that's very cool. Actually, I did go to, just last month, I went to ETH Waterloo and it was great. And the energy is still there. Very interesting thing is like, I feel like there's often themes, like in 2018, as you were saying, I saw so much of energy and attention was around reducing the gas fees, increasing the throughput, and all that stable coins, DeFi, those sort of projects being built. This time, there were around 128 projects were built, or that many teams that submitted a hackathon project. And I can pretty much divide into just two sections. One had something to do with zero knowledge proofs or ZK rollups or something to do with zero knowledge and identity and privacy. And then the other side had something to do with AI, the other half. That's pretty much, or some had a cross-section of both, some using some sort of a GPT tool or using that API to churn through data. So that was a very clear sort of a pathway or direction. That's why I still like going to hackathons just to see and interview founders and see what the next generation is building. So because I believe that's the product that we'll be using in the next few years, and it gives kind of an indication for someone new to zero knowledge. How would you explain like what is zero knowledge proofs or what is zero knowledge and how does it work with Ironfish?
Yeah, so zero knowledge proof, just to kind of give a brief history, if I may.
Sure, go ahead.
Zero knowledge proofs were first kind of coined or invented in the 80s by Shafi Goldwasser, who was a Turing Award winner, and a few other co-authors. And at the time in the 80s, it was an interactive, meaning that two parties had to be kind of online interacting at the same time in order for the protocol to work. And so it was largely kind of like unused because it wasn't quite practical in real life applications. So fast forward to like early 2000s is when we started to have SNARKs, which are succinct non-interactive arguments in knowledge. So it's the ability for you to non-interactively be able to prove to a different party a certain statement about a computation. So to give you kind of like one example is like what zero-knowledge proofs could do is you could prove that this output is correct given a certain computation without giving any information about the inputs. So like one example that I like to use is if you go to the grocery store, you know, after you check out all your items, the person, the cashier, can say like you owe $100, and they can give you a proof such that you don't have to recalculate that all the produce that you bought is equal to $100. You just have a proof that says the computation of adding up all those costs is correct, and therefore you owe $100.
Yeah.
So, from the 2000s to like 2019 in particular, 2019 was like an explosive year for zero knowledge proofs. So not only were there, like in 2016 in particular, Jans Broth, who's a professor at University of College London, he made a protocol that we now call Groth 16 because of the paper he published in 2016. That protocol in particular is a type of zero knowledge proof that I believe is still by far the most popular type of zero knowledge proof that people use. I think, although that statement may no longer be correct, given that some of the other projects that are using different types of zero knowledge proof systems are kind of getting more traction. And in 2019, there was explosive kind of academic research on how to make these zero knowledge proof systems not have something called trusted setup, which is something that Groth 16 does have. And then we have major companies such as like Starkware, for instance, that are all about how to make different types of zero knowledge proofs. In their example, they're trying to commercialize Starks, be more kind of approachable to everyday use cases for crypto users. So that's kind of like the brief history in terms of how Ironfish uses zero knowledge proofs. So for us, every single transaction is encrypted. So it hides the sender, the recipient, the amount, and the account or the token type. And even though the transaction is encrypted, the validator, like the full node that is trying to validate all the incoming transactions, is able to use the zero knowledge proof to have the confidence that the transaction is indeed valid, even though a full node can no longer see, all the sensitive information that went into that transaction, such as the sender, the recipient, amount, and token type. So that's how we use them. So basically, the zero knowledge proof statement here is that the encrypted transaction was computed correctly, and that the user is spending funds that they do indeed have, and that those funds are not being spent before. So that's kind of how we use them.
Well, that's fantastic. How did you come up with the name Ironfish, which is so unique for a L1 chain? Because you know how in crypto, so many names are to do with space and astrophysics and all sorts of random things. Yeah. So what's the origin story?
Yeah. So in World War II, encryption was a really big part of warfare, honestly, because
like the Enigma. Machine and stuff. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Because the thought process is that if you have a secure communication channel, you have a huge advantage because you're able to securely communicate with the front lines, for instance. And vice versa, if you're able to, penetrate that encryption on the other side, you have a huge advantage there as well. So encryption was just like a very big part of World War II in general. And on the American side, they realized that there are so few native Navajo speakers, and native Navajo was largely not a written language, that they were able to ask native Navajo speakers to be on the two ends of the communication channel, speaking quote unquote code, but it was largely just native Navajo. And that was actually a secure encryption method until it was declassified in the 60s. And so if you want to hear more about it, that they were called the Code Talkers, and there's like a great documentary on them as well. And so they didn't have like modern words for certain things. And so a submarine became what directly translates to as an ironfish in native Navajo. So for us, it was kind of like a pretty cool, unique combination of like iron and fish are both tradable. It shows that encryption can be used for the side of good and it's underwater. So again, kind of like alludes to privacy. And to your point, it does not sound like a typical crypto project. And so during the naming process, it was that name that kind of kept coming up because it sounded so ridiculous to be used as a crypto project. And that's actually why we chose it. It's because like it doesn't leave your mind. It's like, wow, it seems so atypical that it's hard to forget it.
Yeah, that is so fascinating. And I love it because the thing is that it is a good branding practice to have something that does not sound like every other thing. Otherwise, it gets so diluted. Every second crypto project has a moon or a star or a cosmos or something in their name, some sort of a variation of that in their name. So this makes so much more sense, even from a branding perspective, especially as your brand grows. So that's super fascinating. I love that story. Another trend that I saw was that pretty much nearly every project, this was a trend I saw more in Collision as well that we recently attended, is like every startup, every project says that, oh, this is an AI-enabled, blah, 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 AI this, AI that. What are your thoughts on AI? Do you use it anywhere in your company, in your startup?
Yeah. So firstly, I think that AI and LLMs are going to be touching every single part of the industry. Like, I think like they're going to drastically change how we do work, how we do productivity, how we even do search, like in probably a much shorter time span than you might think right now. So I'm definitely like, you know, AI believer, very bullish in AI in general. And so someone asked me this question, like on one of like Twitter spaces of like, how will AI change crypto? And I like thought to myself, like, I'm not sure if it's going to directly like change crypto. I think AI, again, is going to kind of elevate all industries kind of at the same rate. I'm not sure if AI is going to be specifically like better or worse for crypto than like any other industry. So I use AI actually every single day. Like I use ChatGPT almost every single day. And the reason for that is because ChatGPT is able to like summarize so many things, right? So, yes. So you can kind of like throw at it, like explain to me this concept or like summarize this or give me, you know, like a blurb that I can use. So I use it every day, you know, for code, for instance, like Copilot is pretty powerful. And I think like some of the team members in IF Labs, which is the engineering company behind Ironfish, you know, they use it. I remember one of the engineers was trying to find like they were trying to Google like a Heroku database command or whatever. And they were able to use ChatGPT a lot faster than Google to get to the command that they needed in order to access whatever they were trying to access. Yes. And so I think like that's going to be like more prevalent of like, you know, it's going to kind of elevate how you work and just going to expedite either helping you kind of formulate your own thought process in terms of like your written work or, you know, able to help you with code. Will ChatGPT like replace writers? I don't think so. Like the way I use it currently is like, yes, if I wanted to write a blog post or an article, I would kind of like dump my thoughts into ChatGPT. It would kind of produce like a rough first draft. And then you can, yes, use that for, oh, now I can actually take it and like make it into my own thing. And so that just like, you know, instead of spending like 3 hours on a blog post, I would be able to spend like maybe an hour and a half on a blog post and get to a final result like much faster.
Oh, absolutely. And as you get better and better at prompt engineering, which you will because you're getting so much exposure, that will take 10 minutes or 15 minutes instead of 3 hours. And it's like pretty much every single day I try new AI tools and I use it. I use it more than Google now. And it is very interesting because it's like there were 650 developers at ETH Waterloo. And I was, mm-hmm, just seeing their behavior and what they are doing. And some were frustrated at ChatGPT. And I'll tell you why they were frustrated. But like nearly every single person used ChatGPT there over Google. Mm-hmm. I saw like even like sitting in like an auditorium style when the speeches were going on and just seeing what people were doing on their phone and then going to ChatGPT to search on their phone instead of, yeah, going to Google, and which was like, it's like mind blowing. I thought I'm the only one who's doing that, but no, it's like so many people because you get the information, yeah, paraphrased for you because also these are the developers who are using it every day. So they're getting so good at prompt engineering that they know exactly what to ask.
Totally. Yeah. Just to add on to that, like, yes, I think like if you ask ChatGPT, like, what is a zero knowledge proof? Versus if you just Google, what is a zero knowledge proof? If you Google it, you'll see the Wikipedia article, which is like pretty dense, kind of hard to read. Got like a lot of examples that may not be super useful for you to understand it. Like there's like Alice and Bob running through some cave, right? And like that's an example of a zero knowledge proof. But if you ask ChatGPT, what is a zero knowledge proof? It'll give you a very succinct like 2-paragraph answer. And you're like, oh, wow, thank you.
Yeah.
Like 2 paragraphs. Like I can read this. I can skim it. I don't need to spend so much time like going through like all these different articles. And then the other thing for Solidity, like people are now using it to catch bugs, right? So,
yes. Absolutely.
So if you can't afford a full-blown like audit and you're just trying to like, you know, launch an NFT project over the weekend, you know, ChatGPT is a great way for you to find bugs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And so that brings me to the second thing, the why someone like few people were frustrated because they were really, really good developers and who can create the full app themselves. And their team kept on going to ChatGPT and putting in code that caused issues. So they were really frustrated. But those people are in a minority. And that's why I still believe like, there is still a lot of value in learning to code. So anyone thinking that they can just like, because you have been writing articles, you have been writing and creating content in your own way, and you have original thought, That's why you are more successful at using ChatGPT and getting that information out of it instead of someone who's just starting right now, as in like who hasn't gone through that experience. So yeah, I think knowledge is still, it's still valuable to upskill yourself and not just rely. But yeah, coming back to Ironfish. So what does the next stage for Ironfish look like? What's your biggest challenge and what's your vision for Ironfish?
Yeah, so we did mainnet launch on April 20th. It's limited on very little exchanges. The reason why we did that is we launched in a very conservative way. Not only are we a crypto project launching in probably the most highest scrutiny regulatory environment of all time, but we're also a privacy project. And so the way we launched was very like careful and intentional. You know, it is still available in a few exchanges, which we're super grateful for, but we kind of view mainnet as almost like step zero. Like we launched something that is a privacy platform, but it's kind of in its infancy because we didn't build the bridges yet to it from other chains. So to your earlier question of like, what is our biggest focus next is to build those bridges. So by end of the year, our hope is to get a bridge to Bitcoin and a bridge to Ethereum so that users can actually bridge those assets over to Ironfish and have an anonymity pool for those assets is like start to like kind of build out that user process and make sure that that is as seamless as possible. As we know, privacy tools are not always the easiest tools to use. And so there's like more user friction whenever using privacy kind of centered tools. So our biggest focus is there is to make sure that the user experience is just very smooth.
Well, that's very cool because I think this is something we were talking about last time when we met at Collision as well. And that is that convenience that people want convenience over other things, and people will trade anything for convenience. People will trade money, they'll trade privacy, they'll trade health, they will trade their family, anything for convenience. So it's like, what's your plan? How do you plan to make it more convenient, or just like overall how plan to make crypto convenient? Because that's, I think, what we need for adoption. Because right now, I still feel like there's still so much friction for anyone new to get in the space.
Yeah. I mean, like when we were addressing that, as of now, is to make sure that every time a person interacts with Ironfish, they have a good user experience. So for instance, like the way you can launch a full node, we made that into one command line, you know, one command line tool to actually download the node, and then one more command line to the command line to actually run the node. And then since then, we also launched the node app. So that's a desktop app that anyone can download on pretty much almost any operating system. Now you can have a full-blown experience of running a full node and a wallet within a desktop app. So now anyone can run Ironfish on their computer very, very easily. That's like one way. The other way is like what is convenience? I think like convenience is also things that come out of necessity too. Yes. So for instance, like the reason why we're excited to bridge to Ethereum in particular so that people can bridge over stablecoins over to Ironfish. And now we can have for the very first time ever kind of like a true private stablecoin or like a true like private digital cash. Same thing for Bitcoin, like we can have private Bitcoin for the very first time ever without using mixers. So like that's a really exciting use case for us as well. But then like kind of moving like a little bit further, some of the other use cases that people have been wanting is things like private DAOs. So I want them to be part of a DAO, but I don't want to like reveal my affiliation with a particular entity publicly. And so Ironfish can support private DAOs even today. The other use case is like private NFTs. A lot of times people want to purchase NFTs for investment purpose, right? Like the fact that NFT is public, that's fine, but they don't want to be they want to have their own wallet be associated with that NFT, because if that NFT is very expensive, then they're kind of putting a price tag on their head, basically for phishing attacks and scammers and all that. So, part of the reason why we're building this bridge that we're so excited about it, so that users can actually transfer even their NFTs over to Ironfish and store them in a fully private environment.
That is such an important use case. I never thought about it, but now that you say it, it makes so much sense that there would be a lot of people. Not everyone is public, because I know in 2021, it became like people were buying NFTs to brag about on their Twitter profile or whatever it might be, but not everyone is like that. And a lot of people, when they don't advertise their wealth or they don't believe in that, And there is no way to stay anonymous when it's and most high profile NFTs are all Ethereum based. So they are on a public blockchain. You can see which wallet address owns it and all that. So would you be able to move once you have a bridge to Ethereum? Would you be able to move and Ethereum based like an ape or something like to Ironfish, and then you would get access to that privacy features.
That's what we're working towards. It's not built yet, but yes, that is our goal, to get that. Our goal is to get it by end of year. So engineering timelines don't always work out, but that's kind of the thing that we're aiming for. The other thing that I wanted to mention is, you know, I think like for the longest time, people in crypto didn't necessarily care about privacy because they weren't using crypto for day-to-day payments. Like they weren't using it for quote unquote real things. And so, you know, most people kind of had this thought that like, well, since I'm not using crypto for anything that I care about, then privacy doesn't really matter to me. And I think like for one that is definitely changing, I think people are using crypto more and more as almost like a alternative to their bank account or their savings account, especially with stable coins and the yield that you might get from stable coins using certain protocols. That's changing, firstly. And then the second thing, I don't know if you saw an announcement of Arkham, which is a kind of a platform where people can sell and buy information about a certain account. So it's basically like a data brokerage for linking people's accounts to their real identities. So you can say like, oh, this account that is holding this ape belongs to this particular person with like their name associated with it.
Yeah.
So that just launched, or their announcement launched about a week ago. And it kind of like, you know, took crypto Twitter by a storm of people being like, wow, this is so unethical. How can you be linking like people's real identities to their on-chain activity? And their pushback was like, well, this information has been available this entire time. We're not doing anything quote unquote new. We're just doing like a, you know, kind of a product around something that already existed. So if you're not familiar with it, you just kind of like go on Twitter and like search for Arkham.
I will definitely have a look. I came across another tool at ETH Waterloo in the Zapper or something .xyz. I forgot the exact spelling. Oh yeah. Awesome. I'll check it out. So in that tool, basically you can put anyone's ENS.
Oh yeah.
And then you can see everything that they hold in that wallet and everything, transactions that they have made, and ENS or like a wallet address, if you have wallet address, which most people don't. But ENS, most people have it on their Twitter. So you can use that or even guess an ENS of someone. That's so easy. And you can see all the assets that they hold, which is fine for now because it is such a niche audience who want to brag about the NFTs that they own. It's fine for now, but then I can see it changing over time, these sort of things changing over time. Yeah.
I'm not sure if it's Zapper. Maybe it is. I just don't remember. But I remember there was a tool that also linked to your accounts. Like, let's say you're using ENS as your like quote unquote main wallet, and maybe for a certain transaction you might want to create a different wallet just to quote unquote anonymize yourself. Well, there was a website that basically linked all of those wallets together.
I have seen that. I saw that as well. I don't think it's Zapper, but it is something very similar. Various. It links all your accounts and it shows.
Yeah.
And then you can click an ad and you can show your whole portfolio of everything that you have owned. But as you say, that people don't care about it right now, but they will eventually care. And it is one of those things that identity is such a funny one and privacy is such a funny one that you either don't care about it at all and it doesn't matter at all, or it really, really, really matters. It's like, I don't know if you saw that case of that commander or someone in Russia recently who was he was using Strava, the app, the running app Strava, and every day he would share on Strava where he runs, his running route, and he got shot dead. He was like a very high profile person in Russia, in Moscow somewhere. That has been a vulnerability with a US army as well. In US, they used to run in, I think, Afghanistan or Iraq, like they used to run in a compound, and everyone's Strava would map out exactly at what time all these soldiers are going out running in the compound and where they are. And people could get the map of the US compound from that. So it is like people don't think about it, and it doesn't matter until it really, really matters, like things like privacy. So as you say, that people don't think about it right now, but eventually it will really, really matter. And hopefully you've got the timing right, because timing is such a big thing for startups to be in the right time at the right place for adoption. So yeah, what about your other, and do you have any other thoughts about adoption for crypto? Where do you think it's going? Where do you think we are at? And also, what do you think will change things for more people to adopt crypto?
Yeah. So you know, especially in the bear market, we're kind of forced to ask this question of like, what is working in crypto? Like if you remove the fluff and kind of remove all the like noise and excitement and all the hype, like what are the things that are actually bringing people value? And I think stablecoins are one very, very clear example. Like it is much faster to send someone a stablecoin than it is to send them a wire 100%. You know, like especially now that we're kind of running the foundation, like we're working with more vendors, you know, across the globe, you know, just being able to like open up a MetaMask and like send them a transaction is such a much more seamless transaction than to try and like send them a wire, right? And, you know, crypto doesn't care if you're trying to send them $1, if you're trying to send them an NFT, or if you're trying to send them $1 million, right? Yeah. Like, you know, that, like that, the flexibility of the amount is just, you know, like it's great. Like if you're trying to use your bank account for like more than a certain transaction, then like all of a sudden you have to be a bit more cognizant of what's happening. And so crypto just gives you like more and more freedom and flexibility. The other thing is that like outside the United States, it's much harder to get access to dollars. And so that has been a really clear use case as well. What was interesting to me is that USDT is like so much bigger outside the United States. Like within the United States, everyone kind of uses USDC. And, you know, I haven't heard of people using anything other than that for stablecoins, at least, you know, kind of as a general blanket statement. And outside the US, it's like USDT is king, which is very interesting as well. So I think yield. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, another thing. I didn't know this, but BUSD is very big in Asia and a lot of countries around the world. And BUSD, like this is also at ETH Denver because we were sharing Ubers and sharing food and sharing accommodation and doing all sorts of things and spending money. And this is like 10, 20 of us, you know, like from all different companies, different founders and stuff hanging around together. And how do we pay each other? We don't have a US social security number, so we can't get a bank account in US. So we cannot have Venmo. So there is no such thing. So we all do stablecoins, and we used everything from USDC to USDT to BUSD, and BUSD was the cheapest transaction by far. And all the ones from Asia, they all ask for BUSD. So that was like enlightening for me because I never used BUSD before that date. So yeah, but anyway, continue. Sorry.
No, that's so interesting. Yeah. And I think like on that same line of thought, like yield on stable coins, I think that's working. And there's just so many other like tools out there that makes that experience easier. So if you have a stable coin, you can use like a plethora of different services. Same thing with ETH. Like I think I haven't used Lido personally, but like, you know, kind of like looking at the documentation, just being able to stake your ETH in a very like seamless environment. I think like that's great. And I think like, you know, their market gap kind of shows how many people are, you know, willing to use it, which I think is great. So I think like yield stable coins in the last use case is Bitcoin. Like I think Bitcoin is working. Like you can't just ignore the market cap that it has and like the social kind of clout that it has globally. I think it's definitely
very big brand. Massive brand.
Well, I mean, like crypto and Bitcoin for the longest time have been synonymous. Yeah, I think like Ethereum and Ethereum assets are like finally gaining some mind share. But yeah, I think like those three things are working. And so for iFresh in particular, it's like looking at that, like, you know, stable coins are working, Bitcoin is working. And I guess the other one that I didn't mention is like NFTs. I think NFTs are working, even though the hype cycle is a bit over now. But I think like NFTs by themselves are just like they're not dead. I think they're going to come back in a different format. I think people are going to realize that I can use NFTs to represent so many other things, like ownership and certain things or royalties or whatever that mechanism is. And so for IronFish, like we're kind of looking at it of like, okay, stable coins, yield, Bitcoin, and NFTs.
More, gambling. Gambling, speculation, all that is working. Like, I mean,
that's true.
Whether we like it or not.
Gambling in terms of IronFish side, but in terms of everything.
Talking about what's working. People go to Vegas for entertainment. That's fine. You know, it is what it is. I'm not talking about it as investment. Yeah, that Bitcoin works as store of value. But a lot of people buy NFTs and they were in 2021 with the thought of flipping them or trading them. You know, they weren't buying it for social cloud. A lot of people, like especially smaller projects and stuff. And even now people buy altcoins or shitcoins or whatever you want to define them for, they trade them. And that's just a type of gambling. I mean, they might call it trading, but I call it gambling. And that's a very, very big use case for a lot of people. People do it not even sometimes for making money. They do it for the thrill of it. And it is you. So you can call it as a game. Yeah. So that's, but anyway, continue saying.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, like, you know, for us, like, I want to focus on use cases that actually help people. And I think, like, yes, you know, giving privacy to stables and giving a way for them to still earn yield on those stables while retaining privacy, like, I think that is very interesting. And so at Ironfish, it's kind of like, you know, now that we're embarking on the next stage, which is like, okay, we ship mainnet, is very much in its infancy, but now we're building those bridges to Ethereum, and now we're thinking of products in the context of Ethereum. Like, how do we preserve all of that? How do we preserve the, you know, for users to have access to stables in a private way, for them to earn yield for it, and how do we, like, add privacy to Bitcoin, which I think is working. So that's kind of like, you know, the strategy that we have in the context that I see crypto in.
Oh, that's pretty cool. But yeah, I agree. I agree with all those use cases. And that's where I see, because when I talk with people, I've seen them use one of these use cases or all of them or a few of these use cases. But very few people use or think about privacy, even in our industry, on a day-to-day space. So hopefully they will want privacy as it gets more socially accepted and stuff. What about on the regulation side? Where do you see US? Where do you see we are going? And also what you would like to see?
Yeah. I mean, I think the entire crypto industry is, like, heavily obsessed about the regulatory environment for crypto today in the United States. You know, I think the Ripple case is very interesting. I don't know if you're familiar with Ripple case and its outcome. And, you know, my high level kind of takeaway from that is, and I'm still trying to digest what that means and how it'll potentially, like, change crypto going forward. You know, the case basically said that when Ripple sold tokens to investors, that was a security. But when that token was on exchanges, that was not a security. Secondary sales of that token was not a security. And the rationale was that when a buyer was using that exchange, they didn't know who they were buying the token from. Were they buying it from Ripple itself or a secondary sale from a fellow user like themselves? And so because of that, it wasn't a contract of investment, because it was unclear to them who they were buying for, and therefore it could not possibly have been a contract of investment. So that to me is, like, very interesting. And, like, we're still kind of waiting for it to settle because the SEC might appeal. And if the SEC appeals, then Rebecca scores zero, in my opinion, because it's like, well, there's no grounds that we can use, you know, for future logic. But in general, like, if that sticks, I think that'll be huge, because finally we have some clarification of, like, what is the user journey or, like, the life cycle of a token, of how it kind of starts off at being as a security and then, like, evolves into being auto security. But, you know, again, it's kind of still in flux, and so we're still, I think, as an industry, are trying to, like, look very carefully at what's going to happen next. For us, so for Ironfish, we're also a privacy chain. And so for us, like, having, like, regulation in the context of privacy is, like, a whole different beast, right? Because we feel globally, there are whole countries that have banned privacy coins, right? Like, Japan and Korea, for instance, are very anti-privacy, UK as well, right? And so there's, like, kind of thinking about, like, you know, these are the same countries, to a large extent, that believe in data privacy, but somehow financial privacy to them does not mean that's, you know, the same thing. So for us, it's like, how do we promote privacy? Because we think that privacy is a net good for the world, and we think it's a net good for the average consumer. And how do we kind of balance that with compliance and making sure that we do catch bad actors that do enter the system? But also, how do we make sure that those regulators in those countries are starting to feel more and more comfortable with privacy, you know, coming from this context of, like, we actually think it's a net good for the, you know, for the world and the average consumer?
But, like, from my understanding of Ironfish, from when we were talking last time, is that it does help the regulators, doesn't it? Like, you know, that you can have some sort of an access key. So you can, like, because of zero knowledge, you can provide access to who you want, when you want, without exposing everything. So isn't it a good thing for, I don't know.
That's a great question. Yeah. So the way Ironfish works today is, you know, if you have an Ethereum wallet right now, you have a private key and a public key. Private key lets you spend, public key lets you request money. For Ironfish, we have a private key, public key, and a view key. And the creator of the wallet has access to all those three keys. The view key, if I were to give you a view key for my wallet, you will be able to see every single transaction that went into my wallet. So we have what's called a complete view key, which kind of differs from some of the other privacy chains that also use the same terminology. Our view key gives you full access. So it shows you all of the transactional details for all incoming transactions. So who the sender was, the amount, the token type, timestamp, everything and all the details for the outgoing transactions as well. So the reason why we built this so that a regulated entity could provide an audit for the hosted accounts that they have. And you want to make sure that people understand that this does not mean that Artfish has a backdoor. There is no global view key. These view keys are per account wallet base level only, meaning that if you create your account, just like you have access to your private key and nobody else, well, you have access to that view key, nobody else, unless you give it to someone else. So I do want to make sure that's really clear, because in the past there was confusion about whether or not Artfish is a backdoor. And no, we certainly do not.
That is really, really good to clarify that, because that was going to be my next question. Thanks for clarifying that. And there's another thing that we did talk about. So what happens if you have given the view key to someone and then you want to revoke access to that? And that's when you say that you just move it to another wallet or something like
correct.
That.
You cannot revoke access to a view key, unfortunately. So if you wanted that privacy,
move it to another address. Yeah. So you still can. And this way you retain the control. So I think this is so much of a better solution that I feel like, I'm not a regulator, but this is what regulators should allow so that people don't end up going to things like mixers and things like that. In your point of view, you know, you describe all the different use cases of crypto currently. Which users or which use cases do you, in your point of view, think care the most about privacy out of all those?
So I think it's everything that I mentioned. I think like people who are starting to realize that crypto is not just a speculative asset, that we can use it for like real returns or like an alternative bank account or payment system. You know, I think all those reasons. I mean, for business confidentiality, I think it's a must. Like you can't really convince a business to operate 100% in the open, because that would reveal so much about their business or about their users. You know, there are certain people that just want privacy. Like there's nothing wrong with that. I think like the way crypto works today is like 180 degrees from how financial system works outside of crypto, right? Like imagine every single transaction that you've done ever is a publicly available. It's like Venmo public, but on every single thing that you've done, right? Because that's how crypto works today. And so the way that I like to allude it is like a Black Mirror episode, right? Like, you know, if you have a stalker, they know exactly when you're going to the grocery store, when you're away from your house, or like what coffee shop you use. Like they know
a Strava app for all your financial transactions. That's crypto.
Exactly. So that's how crypto works today. And so people ask me like, well, who would your, like, what are the users that like care about privacy? And my answer is, aren't we all like, don't we all care about privacy? And, you know, to your point, there's certainly like use cases that have more of a need for privacy, like the ones that I mentioned. I think payments, like we use stable coins, but I think private payments or like private stable coins, I would be the first person to use it, honestly. Like right now I use UCT or USDT to like pay bills or pay like invoices and whatnot. And like, that's all out in the open, right? So like who we have interactions with, like if someone figures out what the Artfish wallet is, which is honestly not very hard, they'll be able to see all the transactions that we've done, which I think is like pretty uncomfortable for me, honestly. We do operate in the open, like everything which is out in the open. And so maybe it doesn't matter, quote unquote, but like it would still make me feel a lot more comfortable if I had more of a control of who sees that information. And that's the other things that I mentioned as well, like private DAOs, private NFTs and all that.
Fantastic. Do you have an ask? Is there anything you're looking for? Like whether it is anything, investment, people to join your team, people to try out a part of your product, anything, feel free to share.
Yeah, I mean, please join our Discord. It's discord.ironfish.net. That's how you get there. Our Twitter is Artfish Crypto. So if you want any news about Artfish, just go there. And then we're always available. Like we're always in Discord. We're always here. You know, we are mainnet launch. You can mine it today. You can buy it today. You can use it today. We are still in our infancy. And so if you are a builder, if you're working on a wallet, if you're working on a bridge, if you're curious about how to add privacy to your existing assets, especially ones on Ethereum, please come talk to us as well. We're here. We're trying to build out the ecosystem. And so definitely trying to attract more builders who are privacy focused and kind of open-minded. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you. Thank you so much for that. Yes, now I got that question again, like when you were talking about private and public and how you can never convince, say, banks or like everyone to put everything on a public blockchain. They are just not going to do. And I remember in 2018, I was working with a company in San Francisco. So I was based there and I met people from different banks. Everyone was looking into private blockchains at that time in 2017, 2018. And I don't know what happened that none of them accounted for anything. Like, I don't know what happened to all these private blockchains. I've talked to people from Wells Fargo and a few other banks that I just met at events and stuff. They were all had their own teams. working on some sort of a private blockchain and exploring this technology to store data instead of the traditional RDBMS or relational database management systems and keeping user accounts and all sorts of things. But I don't know what happened. Why did the private blockchains didn't succeed?
So I don't know exactly, but I think like my read on that is like permission blockchains, like you said, are not any different than using a database, right? And so like, if you're already going to have a permission set of users who are able to participate in your blockchain, then why are you making your life harder? You might as well just use a database and API for that. So, but to your point, like, why were they looking for these permission blockchains or like, you know, private blockchains, right? And it's because privacy aspect was important to them. Like, you know, if you have several banks kind of working with each other, they don't want all of that information to be accessible to the entire world, right? To like their competitors, to people trying to get user data or trying to like, you know, like use that user data, you know, instead of buying it, they could just use it. So I think like there's a lot of appeal for like a private environment for a blockchain. And I think the reason why it sizzled out is because it defeats the purpose of what a blockchain is, which is like it's a decentralized data structure. And if you have a permission set, then it's not, it kind of goes against what the ethos of the technology is, if that makes sense. So I think there's just a friction between those two concepts of like, I want something private and permissioned, but I also want something decentralized. But those two things don't really go together.
Yep. And I interviewed someone from the banking sector who advises like governments of some like smaller countries and stuff on private versus public blockchain and also on the central bank digital currencies. And his point of view is that the public blockchains will always move faster because there will always be more people working on public blockchain from all around the world. And so it will always foster more innovation. Whereas a government only has to rely on their internal, like a central bank digital currency or something else has to rely on their own pool of talent. Whereas with blockchain, things move faster in our industry, which I'm sure you would feel like it moves so much faster than Web 2 world and Web 3, is because you don't have to wait for a company to give you API access. You have everything is out there. You can just build on top of it, permissionless. And so that is a feature. Won't privacy defeat that?
No, so I'm glad you asked that. So I think there's a, especially when we started, it was just closer to the 2017 era of like private blockchains. Yes. There was this confusion, like, what is a privacy blockchain versus a private blockchain? So I'm glad you asked that. So private blockchain means that you have a permission set of users that can propose blocks or who can participate in doing anything with a blockchain. A privacy blockchain is actually a public blockchain in the sense that anyone can access it, public access, but the actual transaction details are hidden. And that's exactly how Ironfish works. So anyone can run a node. If you want to install, if you have like Node on your computer right now, you can just open up your terminal, type in npm install -g ironfish. It was just one command line. You'll be able to get a full SDK. Again, if you want to use Node app up on our website as well. So anyone can run a full node. Anyone can mine. We have several mining pools that are supporting Ironfish today that you can join to mine more Ironfish. So the access is 100% public access, but the actual information is private, meaning that if you go to our block explorer, you would not be able to see the rich list or like account details, right? You would not be able to see transaction details. You'll be able to see that transaction has occurred and how like the number of inputs and outputs per a certain transaction, but that's it. Everything else is fully hidden.
Oh, that's fantastic. You explained it so well. Thank you. Thank you so much for that. And yeah, I think you have answered pretty much all my questions. So that's fantastic. I think this has been the most in-depth on the privacy side of things. So thank you so much for your time. And yeah, just want to wish you best of luck for Ironfish and so keen to see where you guys go. Would love to do this again, maybe sometime early next year, once you have launched a few more of the things that are on your roadmap and see where you guys are at. So lovely. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Bye.
Thanks. Bye. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening or watching this episode of the Web3 with Sam Kamani podcast. By now, you know the drill. Leave a comment or share this episode with a friend and leave a review. I would love to hear from you. So that's why my DMs are open. Reach out to me, especially if you are a founder building a product in Web3. Then I would love to hear from you. What are your challenges? Is there anything that I can help you or my community can help you with? Thank you once again and wish you best of luck in building your startup or your project.